Hello and welcome to the APAC File, the joint bi-weekly podcast of Radio Free Albedo Liberty and the Wilson Center focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Albedo Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. Afghanistan remains one of the most corrupt countries on earth. This is according to the recent annual corruption index by Transparency International, where Afghanistan ranked 173rd place on the list of 180 countries. You might also recall the decision by the State Department last year in September to cut $100 million in aid, citing government corruption. So corruption is a constant headline coming out of Afghanistan. So we thought, why not to do a reality check to assess how bad is the problem, what is causing it, and what could possibly reverse the process. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Karen Coates, an independent consultant focusing on international development and security sector reform with over two decades of experience in Afghanistan. Sayed Ikram Afzali, Executive Director of Integrity Watch Afghanistan. Mustafa Server, Senior Journalist with Radio Free Albedo Liberty's Afghanistan Service Radio Azadi. And Michael Kugelman, Senior South Asia Fellow and the Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Asia Programs. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So today's discussion, in part inspired by Transparency International's latest corruption index, where Afghanistan was placed almost at the bottom of the report. So, Mr. Afzali, I guess your organization had to do something with this report. So first of all, tell us, please, what has been the contribution of the Integrity Watch to this index?
We, every year when TIA launches the CPI report, we have local engagement with our media here in Kabul. We also organize events to discuss the issue of corruption and why Afghanistan consistently fails to improve things in a drastic way, despite many commitments by the Afghan government. But we also have our own surveys on corruption issues, which we do every 2 years, which basically portrays not a very different picture from what CPI actually every year indicates about corruption in Afghanistan.
Now, Mr. Afzali, please unpack this huge document for us. How Afghanistan ended up where it is? What are some of the calculations and indicators leading to this conclusion?
So there are 13 different indicators that are used in the composite index by TI. I think most important indicators are the rule of law index and also the World Bank index on doing business, which basically has not really improved in the last couple of years. So Afghanistan scored only 16 out of 100 this year, which was the same as last year. In the last 5 years, Afghanistan's score has only improved, I think, five or six scores, which is not huge, given the context that we are in and the commitments that were made by President Ghani to, you know, score at least 50 on CPI in his 5 years. But unfortunately, you know, things have not improved in terms of doing business in Afghanistan very much, and also in terms of rule of law, which is very important in order to tackle the issue of corruption. So things have stalled due to political issues, including elections in the last 2 years. There has been a lot of focus on that by President Ghani and CEO Abdullah. And also because of peace issues, anti-corruption has unfortunately taken a back seat.
Okay. Karen, any surprise when you look into this report?
To be honest, not necessarily. I think, as has already been said, I think while we see over the past couple of years, you know, some minor improvements in Afghanistan's ranking, I think, especially recently, what we've also seen in the news with the Washington Post and Afghanistan papers, various CBAR reports on corruption in Afghanistan and testimonies to that effect, I don't think it was necessarily a surprise that Afghanistan is about where it has been. And yet, I don't know that necessarily that should be taken as a completely sort of negative thing or a bad news story. I was looking over again some of the latest reports from CGAR and mentioned some of the recent UN and UNAMA reports. But, you know, in terms of the national picture, what the Afghan government is doing through the High Council for Rule of Law and Anti-Corruption, through its anti-corruption law and anti-corruption strategy, there has been progress on hitting different benchmarks, on meeting specific benchmarks that have been set. But they're acknowledging, as well as a number of people, that not to take away from the success of that for the government, for the institutions, it's always good to hit a benchmark. And yet recognizing that that's not necessarily enough, that we can sort of hit the benchmarks and yet miss the goal or the overall intent. of those benchmarks. And so I think for me, the Transparency International report seemed to confirm kind of that same idea that while there are some great examples of improvements at kind of a more micro level, but at the macro level, the big picture is going to take a long time to change. I think for me, one thing that's encouraging is that, you know, a lot of what used to be sort of whispered about behind closed doors or a little bit grumbled about by folks on the field is now on the front page in terms of people are talking about the issue of corruption, not just, you know, Afghans in Afghanistan, also international community, back here in D.C., policymakers. You know, it's not just being whispered about that corruption is an issue, that it's a risk to national security and to objectives that international funding has helped fuel. Certain kinds of corruption. You know, these things that in my time in Afghanistan you kind of whispered about are now much more publicly acknowledged and recognized, which I think gives us a great opportunity to say, okay, well then, so what? What do we do about it?
Yeah, definitely we are going to talk about
where we're able to sort of behavior change.
Yeah, we are going to talk about some of the factors contributing to this situation. Mustafa, also, let me bring you in here. So when I think of corruption in Afghanistan from 10,000 feet above, I see things like the Kabul Bank scandal, although it's an old story now. But of course, you guys follow this none like others. When we say corruption, what comes to your mind? How much of a factor is this in the day-to-day life of ordinary people?
When we talk to the ordinary people in Afghanistan on a daily basis through our programs, radio programs and TV programs, they say that corruption is the mother of all threats in Afghanistan and to Afghanistan, because they think that aside from poverty and insecurity and violence, their biggest and major worry is corruption in Afghanistan. It's a complex and multifaceted issue because it involves, as you know, a variety of stakeholders, the Afghan government, the international community, donor countries, and the ordinary Afghans. Let me tell you that how this report was perceived in Afghanistan. Opinion is divided on this issue. For example, when you talk to the Afghan government authorities, the presidential palace, when we talk to one of their spokespersons, they said the report needs to be scrutinized because they said the president has taken serious steps in the fight against corruption. They also mentioned that President Ghani has launched a national anti-corruption strategy that rests on five pillars, namely security reform, improving the quality of civil service recruitment, national leadership, and increasing the ability to oversee how money is transferred and spent. As our colleague in Kabul said, when we talked to Integrity Watch, an Afghan civil society organization, I'm happy that we have Ikram Afzali from Kabul. So he said interestingly that it took 5 years for the National Unity Government to establish a commission to fight corruption. So when you talk to the ordinary people, they are very impatient in terms of this, and they are very worried about large-scale, medium-scale, and small-scale corruption. They say that it has impacted all aspects of their lives. For example, they're talking about bribery, land grabbings, and other forms of corruption.
Mustafa, on that point, let me ask you, so which are the sectors people will likely face more corruption than any other sector?
Government institutions that people, you know, have to deal with on a daily basis, they generally complain of a lack of transparency and responsiveness in terms of providing of basic services to people. So they complain also of lack of rule of law. And another major aspect of their complaint is that, you know, there's impunity in the government, the big shots, the big wheel, the authorities, when they commit a crime or when they are involved in high-scale corruption, they, you know, are not tried properly. So basically, these are the major...
Mustafa, any specific institution that stands out?
Well, they, generally speaking, you know, they say that corruption exists in all sectors of the Afghan government, despite the fact that I said that the authorities say that they have made tremendous progress in the past 18 years. For example, they claim that they don't have schools in many parts of Afghanistan. They don't have health clinics. For example, we have reports from Oruzgan, from Nuristan, from Paktia, from places in central Afghanistan, in northern Afghanistan, that they complain that even they are deprived of having access.
But Mustafa, what it has to do with corruption?
Well, so it has direct links with corruption, and you know the important thing that they say it undermines rule of law and peace and security, because you know security and health is something that people in Afghanistan they care a lot about. When we talk about security, they feel insecure in their places. We have 40,000 villages all over the country. We're not talking about, you know, big cities like Kabul or Nangarhar or Jalalabad or Kandahar or Mazar-e-Sharif. But, you know, rural areas, remote areas, these are the major, you know, problems of people, lack of responsibility, lack of accountability, lack of responsiveness, lack of all-inclusiveness, and some even say that there's no political will to provide balanced opportunities to, you know, everyone in Afghanistan. So these are basically the complaints that we're receiving from ordinary Afghans on a regular basis.
Right. Thank you, Mustafa. When you look into countries in South Asia, especially Pakistan, I believe to some extent India, police department stands out as one of the most corrupt institutions. Michael, let me also bring you in here. Of course, corruption is a broad, and we won't be able to look into every aspect in this discussion. I also recall a decision by the State Department last year when they decided to hold $100 million aid, citing government corruptions. What was that about? What is that U.S. is concerned when it comes to corruption?
Yeah, thanks, Mohammed. It's a great question. I mean, of course, corruption has always been a big concern for the U.S. government in Afghanistan, but particularly with the Trump administration, which, you know, carries this kind of what have you done for me lately kind of position on everything when it comes to international affairs. And I think that the Trump administration really wants more assurances that all of this money that's going into Afghanistan isn't just going down the drain. And I think that you know, that move that you cited before, when the government decided to suspend a fair amount of assistance, it was meant to deliver a message to the Afghan government, which, and I think the timing was significant. The move was made just before the September presidential election. And I think that it was meant to signal that you know, the U.S. takes these issues of accountability seriously, and regardless of who's heading up the next government in Afghanistan, it will continue to take those issues seriously. And just the other day, there was a long on-the-record briefing that Alice Wells, the top South Asia official at the State Department, gave, and she did weigh in on corruption in Afghanistan a bit, and she was actually fairly positive in her assessment. She said that we've seen some progress by the government of Afghanistan lately, but you know, what I thought was interesting, her main message is that we're seeing less money. You know, we're seeing declining levels of economic assistance coming into Afghanistan now, and I think she was referring globally, not just to the U.S., because there's less money coming in, suggesting a level of donor fatigue. And particularly looking to the day when, you know, U.S. forces could be leaving Afghanistan, you know, there's really more at stake for Afghanistan now. You're looking at an increasingly impatient donor community. You're looking at a situation where there may not be as much aid flowing into Afghanistan not too long from now, meaning that there should be a particularly strong incentive for the government in Afghanistan to manage what money continues to come in. I mean, it's advice that may well fall on deaf ears, but I think it's worth highlighting. Finally, interesting angle here is President Ghani himself, someone who, you know, as we all know, spent many years working here in D.C. at the World Bank, and he came out with this very influential book that he, I think, co-published with Claire Lockhart, Fixing Failed States. And so he knows about corruption. He knows what the story is with corruption in Afghanistan. And he did make a major effort, as I understand it, to try to make some progress on this issue. But, you know, given the scale of the challenge, you know, even if you have one leader who has a very clear inclination and desire to try to make progress, you know, it's going to take a very long time.
Yeah, and also I just wanted to remind that please jump in whenever you want to respond or want to add something into what has been just said. Having said that, Mr. Afzali, I wondered how bad things can get Is there any situation? I think I'm lost. I guess my question is there anything, any indicator showing that beyond this line, it is just absolute worst of the worst? How is that situation looks like?
Well, if I understood your question correctly, you're asking basically how worse things can get.
Can get, right.
It's a very interesting question. And, you know, frankly speaking, I never thought about it because I probably believe that, you know, we are pretty close to the worst case scenario. The Afghan government has been kind of alienated from the peace talks, and the U.S. and other donors, you know, as Michael said, feel this fatigue. And, you know, and we are not winning on the battleground against insurgency. You know, I think things cannot get worse than this. You know, we only wait for the results because as a sovereign state, we have to be part of any peace deal. But it looks like, you know, we will end up in a situation where, you know, we will not be able to have much influence after the U.S. reaches a deal with the Taliban. And that's primarily has to do with the level of corruption and the level of legitimacy of the government within the international community and, you know, with the Afghan public. After, you know, receiving only from U.S. like more than $135 billion in aid and U.S. spending close to $1 trillion in Afghanistan in the war on terror and not getting the results of a stable state that can be relied on, that can stand on its own feet. So, and this is all happening after, you know, 18 years of continuous support to establishing state institutions. So I think, you know, we are in a very bad situation already. I think there is hope still. But, you know, frankly speaking, I'm not sure if you've got the time to fix things before anything happens with the peace talks. As I mentioned, you know, we are losing on the battleground primarily because of corruption, because our security institutions have failed to deliver. And the enemy has been able to win both in terms of gaining ground due to corruption in the military, for example, selling of fuel and ammunition and other military equipment to the insurgents. And also there is talks about like even fighting that happens based on some arrangements between the insurgents and the military, the fake battles that actually then they report spending huge amounts of money on those battles in terms of fuel and ammunition. And then that is pocketed by military people. So in terms of that, and also in terms of rule of law, because our institutions have failed to deliver in terms of justice to the people, the insurgents have been able to gain ground. You know, they have been able to use this situation in their favor by delivering quick justice, although it can be summary justice at times and it can be very brutal. But people don't go to the courts most of the times because they feel there is a lot of corruption there and they don't get justice. So when you're in that kind of situation where people don't trust your justice institutions and the insurgents use that to their advantage and win people's minds, if not hearts, that's where you end up. You know, you lose on the battleground and the insurgents are able to win over people. And then when the peace talks happens, you do not have the kind of influence over the process due to the lack of legitimacy. So I think the implications of corruption on the Afghan situation is tremendous. And unfortunately, we have been saying this for years, but we do not see the kind of urgency within the Afghan leadership, primarily due to their own vested interest. The role of money and politics has been huge. So people pay money to become, you know, MPs, and then they use their positions as members of parliament to win contracts and, you know, to make money and to basically have these illegal armed groups and then engage in organized crimes, you know, including, you know, drug trafficking. So if you get into that situation where the elite sacrifices national interests for their own personal and group interest, then, you know, no matter how much effort you make, it's not going to make a lot of ground unless you try to tackle this through institutions. And this is what we have been saying. You know, the Afghan government should not politicize the justice and anti-corruption institutions and let them do their job. But unfortunately, the Afghan government, you know, after establishing the Anti-Corruption Justice Center, has not really allowed the center to act independently. We have many cases against MPs and against high-level government officials, including ministers, but none of those cases, I think one or two very symbolic cases, were prosecuted. Apart from that, you know, not much has been done to prosecute high-level corruption, you know, cases, which has led to this culture of impunity to continue.
Right.
And therefore, institutions have become paralyzed due to this politicized fight against corruption.
Okay, someone wants to jump in. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Afzali, for the detailed explanation. Of course, there are challenges, numerous challenges in Afghanistan, and I would agree with Michael in his assessment that it will take time, and you cannot tackle corruption in a country like Afghanistan overnight. Let's also bring this up, that Afghanistan that we are talking about today is a very different Afghanistan. For example, we have a vibrant media outlet there in the country as we speak. We have a powerful civil society, and I'm very happy that we have Mr. Afzali as a representative of such a society, that they regularly and continually monitor corruption and other aspects of government dealings in the country. We have educated young cadre nowadays in Afghanistan. So despite the challenges that we have, there is also hope, there is also resilience among a new generation in Afghanistan who wants to have a better life, to change the situation as they can. And another aspect that I just want to quickly add is that continued international engagement in Afghanistan is something that people want to have in Afghanistan in terms of bringing about security and stability. And as we know that NATO and its partners have always said that they would support the Afghan forces throughout 2024.
So this is the situation. So what is causing this? And Mr. Afzali earlier kind of hinted about some of the causes, and also possibly what can be done about it. So let's continue the APAC file, talking about these and many other questions very shortly. Before that, let me recap the debate today on the APAC file. I'm joined by Karen Coates, an independent consultant focusing on institutional development and security sector reform, Sayed Ikram Afzali, executive director of the Integrity Watch Afghanistan, who's joining us from Kabul, Mustafa Server, senior journalist with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Afghanistan service, Radio Azadi, Michael Kugelman, senior South Asia fellow and the deputy director of the Wilson Center's Asia programs. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for Southern Central Asia here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing corruption in Afghanistan in the light of latest Transparency International's Corruption Index, where Afghanistan was placed among the most corrupt countries in the world. So the cause. I heard, Karen, you wanted to add something. So while you say what you have in mind, let's also talk about what is really causing this.
Yeah, I was going to talk about, maybe a few opportunities as well as the cause. I think, we've gotten into sort of the massive sort of aspect of the problem and how far-reaching it is. And I don't think anyone is disagreeing with that. But I think when we hear things like our colleague, you know, discussing the ongoing commitment of NATO and the U.S. for funding the security forces in particular, or issues like the upcoming, the ongoing sort of dialogue surrounding peace and what's going on with the peace and the electoral processes, I think it's not necessarily a time where we can sort of wait or say there's only so much we can do now, but we'll wait until after that. You know, there's research from other countries that shows that, you know, you increase sort of democratic processes, they increase opportunities for corruption or change some of those things. You know, you increase political competition and incentives for people wanting to get involved in the process. And so I think when we look ahead to sort of the not only the election process that's ongoing, but any potential sort of dialogues around peace and around future government, I think it's really imperative that corruption stays on kind of the front burner, stays in the forefront of our dialogue and in our consciousness as kind of the international community, as the Afghan government are making decisions about how to reform institutions, about what to do with national policies and strategies. Because I think if we wait and sort of see how the chips fall and see what the situation is, we've potentially missed some opportunities to put in preventative means. If we can have kind of a more transparent, open dialogue about how some of these things may increase or may change some of the political dynamics, may offer incentives for different people in different places than what we've had before. And so I think it's important to kind of stay abreast of that conversation. I think another thing I wanted to just kind of bring back in was that, you know, the comment was made about the international community withholding funds. And we talk about the role of international funding. We know is decreasing and might continue to do so, but it's still going to be a key player in Afghan development. And I think, for me, I think it was actually seen as sort of a more positive thing that the international community had put criteria on funding and had actually been willing to hold the government to account when it wasn't seeing what it wanted in terms of checks and balances with that funding. I think over the years, we've seen a lot of examples where that sort of stick has been threatened by the international community, but they haven't followed through on that, either because the Afghan government has sort of achieved the benchmark or because there wasn't necessarily the political will to kind of exert the penalty. And I think as we look ahead, looking at the international community being a bit more of a sort of engaged donor in terms of holding the Afghan government accountable, holding the institutions accountable, not just to the processes and to the activities, but to the results over time, is best practice in terms of making sure that we're seeing behavior change, that we're seeing actual implementation.
Thanks, Karin. Of course, while putting pressure on the Afghan government, you also don't like to destabilize this fragile administration there. So very tricky diplomatic balancing act is needed to deal with this situation. Now, let me bring in here Mr. Afzali. I will try to formulate my question in a way that the answer might help us to understand an underlying cause for this problem. So you said, Mr. Afzali, corruption is an endemic problem. So when you look back into a couple of years, what do you see? Has there been any tipping points, any year in which this has spiked?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of solutions, it's important to understand the problems first. And I think, you know, on the part of the international community, while there has been a lot of, you know, messages coming out, we don't see the same level of focus on what, you know, trying to understand what the problem is and on the solutions that needed to be followed. But unfortunately, neither the Afghan government nor the international community has taken the issue of corruption seriously when it comes to, you know, the details of fighting corruption. By that I mean, you know, you cannot build a state without building institutions. You cannot bring checks and balances without ensuring independence of institutions such as the judiciary and, you know, such as the Supreme Audit Office and other anti-corruption agencies. Unfortunately, you know, the international community has not really focused on those aspects of fighting corruption, despite our advocacy for many years. Only recently we have got some support from some of the donors in our advocacy to ensure independence of some of the institutions, such as the Access to Information Commission and, you know, the Anti-Corruption Commission that is yet to be established, and also the Supreme Audit Office or other institutions that you cannot afford to politicize and then expect that, you know, they would fight corruption. I was in a meeting recently, only, you know, yesterday, and because the Supreme Audit Office issued the audit report where they highlighted some of the inconsistencies that were committed by the executive branch of the government, the president himself was kind of, you know, coming down hard on them because on another issue. And we knew that, you know, they were pressing them because they were not happy with the audit report that they independently prepared. You cannot fight corruption with this kind of mindset, where you selectively try to prosecute people or you intervene in the work of the institutions and you basically press them or trying to find reasons to press them because you're not happy with their report that they independently prepared. So I think this kind of mindset, you know, has to change. And the international community has to stress on this and make sure that we have, you know, these independent institutions in place and nobody can interfere with it, the president or any other politician or the parliament. You know, so this is, I think, you know, like the basics of fighting corruption.
Okay, so let's go to source of that. So what do you attribute this type of behavior?
I think it's, first of all, the mindset of our elite, who think that they can run a state in the way they want and they can bend the law to serve their interest. With this kind of mindset, you cannot allow independent institutions to function. So first of all, you have to have that political will to say that, okay, we do not touch these institutions and allow them, you know, and we just allow them to do their job, you know, and even if that means that they go after our own people. And so if that commitment doesn't exist, you cannot hope much from such politicians. So that's, you know, I think the biggest thing to start with. And then when it comes to independence of institutions, you know, it's not just that you can send fancy messages or give fancy speeches and conferences. It's about making sure that they are functionally independent and that they have, you know, independence in terms of their budget. Yesterday, we were, you know, in that High Council meeting. The Supreme Court reported that they had budgetary issues, and the Ministry of Finance, a very low-grade official, was basically telling them how to prepare their budget, while the Constitution basically orders that the Supreme Court or the judiciary, you know, have their own independent budget, and the executive branch cannot restrict them, basically, in terms of preparing their budget. But, you know, a very low-level government official basically intervenes, basically influences the independence of institution. And I met with the Auditor General recently, who was complaining about the role of the Ministry of Finance, who are using their budget-controlling role in order to influence the Supreme Audit Office and their functional issues. So with this kind of a culture within your bureaucracy, it's very difficult to have any hope to be able to fight corruption. So I think, you know, with the political will, you need this culture within the bureaucracy to respect independence of institutions and allow institutions to functionally, and in terms of, you know, budget, they act independently and they're not influenced unduly.
Thank you, Mr. Abzali. So let me expand on that. Karen, because of your background as the long-term advisor to the people on policy level, you have a unique access in understanding of this challenge. So when you were listening to Mr. Abzali arguing about the lack of commitment and political will by the Afghan authorities, what were going through your mind? What's their reasoning and what are their logic behind the way they look into these things or handling of these challenges, the type of challenges that Mr. Abzali was talking about?
I would definitely agree that there are, yeah, as he's mentioned, struggles in autonomy and independence, particularly those entities. I think it's something, as I was listening, my experience is more on the service delivery institution side. And I think you see the same issues, although it's a different form of independence that they're looking for. But you see political interference, you see the struggle of people in the ministries to work independently in a culture of political interference. So that fine line of needing, both from the Afghan authorities and from the international community, needing a certain level of political will, and yet also needing a certain level of independence and autonomy in order to be able to push it and not be spending all of your time kind of catering to the needs of political constituencies. I think for me, it sort of highlighted the importance, too, of that. If we look at solutions, kind of the combination for institutions of needing solutions that are both political, but also have kind of a leadership and a systems or an administrative component to them. There's other factors as well, but I think those are some of the big three where, you know, alongside, even if you get the best kind of independence, the best case scenario with political will, you still need kind of the bureaucracy to be working well. You still need the systems to be working well for the ministry or the institution to run, for them to be gathering data, whether it's a case management system, whether it's the bureaucratic links of reporting between the Attorney General, courts, and the police doctors. You need those things to be working well. If not, you always have the opportunity that sort of bad admin or bad capacity of the systems can be used as an excuse. If you want something to go to prosecution, you need good evidence, and you need solid evidence. And so I think sometimes things that may appear to be corrupt might actually just be that it's bad administration and bad systems. And so until you get those systems up to par, it's sometimes hard to prove corrupt when it gets to that point. You also need the leadership factor on top of that. As we've said before, there's a new young cadre of great leaders coming up into the government and into the institutions. And that's amazing. It's great for short-term kind of quick impact in these days. And yet we also need to see kind of more sort of whole-scale career pathways and HR reforms so that it's not just the lone kind of good, you know, person at the top who's trying to fight the good fight against corruption,
okay.
but other people coming below him or her within the hierarchy to be able to continue those reforms. So really looking at how all of those things connect together. I think that's one of the challenges when we talk about, you know, how can we support this? It's not necessarily going to be one project or one strategic plan that covers all of those things. It's going to be bits and pieces of that over time. But trying to make sure that from the international community side and from the Afghan government's development planning, that we're trying to at least support improvements across those sectors and not just focusing on kind of one piece of the puzzle.
Right, right. Thank you very much. So we discussed lots of negativity on this show. So speaking of corruption, Mustafa, let me bring you in. Is there anything which went right that can be looked at as an example? Any shining personalities, any champions? So just tell me anything that's positive. I'm so desperate to end this discussion with a positive note.
Well, of course, as I mentioned, Afghanistan has come a long way. And as I mentioned before, the existence of a vibrant media in Afghanistan, the role of civil society, the educated young cadre that we have, which we didn't have in the 90s. For example, when I used to study in the 90s in Kabul, we didn't have, you know, people such as Mr. Afzali, who is now with us in the show, an educated Afghan that I'm proud of, you know, the new generation and the young educated Afghans in the country. And the role of women and girls who were deprived, you know, an education during the Taliban, for example, and who were, you know, not allowed to work outside of their homes back then. But now we have millions of, you know, girls back to school. You know, we have a vibrant presence of women in all aspects of life, you know, in high government positions. They are ministers, they are diplomats, they are ambassadors.
Mustafa, these are very positive points, and thank you very much for reiterating them. But my question was rather how these changes are making a difference in practical terms when it comes to curbing the corruption, which, as Mr. Afzali was saying, has reached to an endemic level.
Well, leadership is about change, Tahir. You know, one is management, one is leadership, and I define leadership as change. And we have people, as I mentioned, we have a program called Women Leaders that I initiated years ago. We talked to, you know, ladies inside Afghanistan who were born inside the country and educated inside the country, and now they have done their utmost to change their lives to the positive and change the lives of their children and their families and their communities to the positive, and they have tried their best. For example, we have, I was in Brussels, I was in London in December, and there was a NATO conference in Afghanistan. So I was very impressed by one presentation that was delivered by Ariana Saeed, one of, you know, brilliant Afghan singers and songwriters and women rights activists. And she talked there in a very powerful way, and the audience were very, you know, it was very well received. And she talked about the change. She talked about the positive change. She talked about hope. She talked about, you know, how people change their attitudes. Her work in Afghanistan, how, and how now, you know, many people have changed their mindsets in terms of praising her work, you know, to the audience. So these are all, you know, positive change in Afghanistan, but, you know, many experts in Afghanistan, they believe that it will take time. Afghanistan has come a long way. There are many challenges ahead, of course. And even they say that you cannot fully and completely eliminate corruption. But, of course, you can always reduce the phenomenon relatively based on the benchmark.
Okay.
The recommendations that were put forth by our colleague.
Thank you, Mustafa. So let's end this, Michael, with you. So from Washington papers, earlier Karen also mentioned that. So we learned that the U.S. and international money were both a kind of blessing and curse when it comes to corruption. Is there anything Washington or the international community can do to help Afghanistan fight this endemic, as Mr. Afzali called it?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been enjoying listening to this conversation. I've certainly learned a lot. And, you know, one thing that kept thinking is that, you know, we should rightfully be critical of the Afghan government and its inability to manage, if not tackle, corruption appropriately. But you know, I think it is important that we also turn the lens onto the U.S. aid process, the U.S. development assistance process. And we've touched on this already, I believe, but I just want to emphasize again. I mean, it just seems, it's clear that the U.S. development assistance bureaucracy is incentivized in a way that it just makes more sense to throw seemingly the largest amount of money possible into any one type of project, even when you don't need all that money. And of course, the more money that's out there, the more likely there is to be corruption. And this is something that we don't only see with U.S. assistance in Afghanistan. We see it in other countries, too, including Pakistan. The Wilson Center came out with a pretty detailed study of this problem not too long ago. So I think, you know, this is too ambitious to change overnight, talking about complex challenges. But how could you go about trying to change the incentive structure within the U.S. assistance, development assistance community, and particularly bureaucracy, so that you don't have to always try to make it clear that you're trying to put the most money out there as possible? You know, small scales can work, micro can work. And I think that's, for me, that's what I would leave things with, other than to just reemphasize what I think Karen had said before, that, you know, corruption is not just corruption, it's not just an economic problem, it is very much a security problem. Because when you can have young, poor Afghans that can be recruited to the Taliban cause just because they're convinced that the Taliban is an incorruptible entity that is so much of a more better alternative to the Afghan government, you've got a major problem there. And yeah, it clearly accentuates how corruption can help fuel the insurgency.
Thank you. Thank you. And with this, let's end the discussion here. Thank you, Michael Kugelman, Senior South Asia Fellow and the Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Asia Program. Big thanks goes to Karen Coates, an independent consultant focusing on international development and security sector reform with over two decades of experience in Afghanistan. She was joining us from Washington, D.C. Said Ikram Afzali, Executive Director of the Integrity Watch Afghanistan, was joining us from Kabul. Mustafa Server, Senior Journalist with Radio Free Liberty. Liberty's Afghanistan Service Radio Azadi, was joining us from Prague. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and touch today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the FPAC file. Please join us in 2 weeks. Until then, bye-bye.